This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
On Sunday night, Marvel's Black Panther movie won the Oscar for three of its six Academy Award nominations. Ludwig Göransson for the original score, which you're hearing now, along with Ruth E. Carter for Best Costume Design and Hannah Beechler and J.R. Hart for Best Production Design. Just a few of the artists who helped bring Wakanda, the Black Panther's mythical homeland, to life. It seemed so real that shortly after the film debuted, British tourists reportedly searched the travel booking site Kiwi.com for flights to the fictional nation. Trevor Noah, the South African host of The Daily Show, riffed on this longing for a real Wakanda on stage at the Academy Awards.
Growing up as a young boy in Wakanda, I would see King T'Challa flying over our village, and he would remind me of a great Xhosa phrase, Abelungu abayazi uba ndiyaxoka, which means, in times like these, we are stronger when we fight together than when we try to fight apart.
That phrase, it turns out, actually translates to, white people don't know I'm lying. Black Panther and Wakanda, conceived by Marvel Comics' Stan Lee and Jack Kirby in the 60s, have lately been reframed and reimagined. In 2016 and 17, comic book updates from authors Ta-Nehisi Coates and Roxane Gay explored the Black Panther universe in the context of modern social and political struggle. In Ryan Coogler's 2018 film, Wakanda comes under attack when intruders catch wind of the nation's access to vast reserves of vibranium, the world's hardest metal because it absorbs sound waves and kinetic energy and more.
Tell me something. What do you know about Wakanda?
It's a third world country.
Textiles, shepherds, cool outfits.
All the front. Explorers have searched for it. Called it El Dorado. They looked for it in South America. But it was in Africa the whole time.
Wakanda's hidden riches leads to the movie's central conundrum. Share your wealth with the world and you'll be targeted by predators and pillagers and empires. Keep your natural riches within your borders and you turn your back on the suffering of refugees in the larger African diaspora. Can a country share its good fortune without being forced into a struggle for its own survival? When I spoke with Johns Hopkins University professor Nathan Connolly last February, he said that in the world of Black Panther, Wakanda's survival is made possible in part thanks to its secrecy.
Wakanda is obscured by dense forests and later by a kind of elaborate hologram that allows it to remain hidden from satellites and foreign spies and the like. It's rich beyond imagining, is extraordinarily advanced. In fact, if you look at the original comic book from the mid-60s, what you actually see is a Wakandan using the equivalent of a cell phone with a Bluetooth headset. And so the Wakandans never have to extend beyond their borders to generate wealth. They never have to enslave any other populations. Not like England or France that had an elaborate plantation system in the Americas or any number of countries that colonized the physical continent of Africa. It's a counterpoint to what the actual history of modern wealth creation has been for industrialized countries. The point about the film, of course, is to say, what would it mean if there was a bottomless resource that you could use to basically solve the problem of racism and poverty for all Black people around the world?
In an interview with the New York Times, film director Ava DuVernay, who's about to come out with A Wrinkle in Time, said that Wakanda itself is a dream state, a place that's been in the hearts and minds and spirits of Black people since we were brought here in chains.
So you would have to really begin in the 15-teens with the first maroon communities. The first small number of African slaves ran off into the hills over Santo Domingo to escape the brutalities of slavery and colonization. And, you know, maroon communities are very much like Wakanda in function. They're meant to exist outside of the watchful eye of European powers, places of autonomy. In Dutch Suriname, in the United States, multiple centuries of dreaming about places of independence, feeding into what ultimately becomes the vision of Wakanda.
And you focused particularly on the connection between Black utopian thought and the founding of Haiti, and tied that into Wakanda.
So Haiti is critical, but in that 1804, what you have is the first modern nation state established by Black people, a Black republic in a kind of European and Euro-American model. It is unthinkable that people would be able to remove themselves from the bondage of slavery, then establish a country, write a constitution, develop an economy. This is a dangerous, dangerous idea that the country of Haiti could be on America's doorstep and possibly encourage slave revolts.
Because of the uprising at the end of the 1700s, which gave rise ultimately to its independence.
Correct. It's Haiti as an idea that I think is largely what the film and what the comic book series was built upon. The other thing is, if you think about where Wakanda comes from, even in the minds of comic book creators like Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, it absolutely is part of a flowering of ideas about Black nationalism in the mid-1960s. So you have people who are returning to the history of the Haitian Revolution because they're looking at models for Black self-determination. So a very important book that was written in 1938 by a historian named C.L.R. James called Black Jacobins, and it was considered to be the dominant kind of take on the Haitian Revolution. It falls out of print within a decade of coming out, but it comes back into print in 1963 because American readers, and particularly civil rights activists, are looking for models of Black self-determination. The first comic book treatment of the Haitian Revolution is the same exact year that Black Panther is established in Marvel Comics. And of course, then later, the Black Panther Party, after the comic book already comes out, is established in Oakland, California. All this to say that you cannot disentangle the scholarship on the Haitian Revolution, the historical events and the imagining of the Haitian Revolution from what becomes seemingly an innocuous fictional treatment. And again, the concern and the question about what's the responsibility and the place of a Black nation in a larger world of oppressed people, that's a question that was raised from the inception of Haiti as a country in 1804.
What makes you so sure that these Jewish outsiders in the mid-last century, Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, that they had really encountered this material and were referencing it?
So ideas about Black nationhood are everywhere in the mid-1960s. You don't have to place Stan Lee or Jack Kirby in a meeting with a kind of Back to Africa movement to understand that there's already going to be a very wide and broad set of discussions and conversations in the newspaper, in public meeting places, where the idea of Black autonomy is going to be front and center for them. And I'll also say, if you talk to Stan Lee about even the creation of other non-Black characters like the X-Men, he's drawing explicitly from the civil rights movement. So Professor X is meant to hearken to Martin Luther King. Malcolm X is represented through the character of Magneto. And it's yet another example of the politics of the 1960s being turned into the creative fodder for really iconic treatments in Marvel Comics pages.
And you wrote, "Dreams to Art to Life and Back Again." You were basically saying that you can't approach it until you dream it.
Yeah, I mean, the story about, you know, say the Haitian Revolution or maroon communities or even the civil rights movement, they begin with visions. They begin with imagination. They begin with the creative process, right? None of this is possible until you dream it. The power of a film like Black Panther and what people are really responding to is the fact that this is a vision that they have never seen before. It's suggesting that there is a way for an African nation to be the most advanced nation in the world, that it might well be possible to have advancement without environmental degradation.
When we talk about the utopianism of Wakanda, we have to concede that it's based on unlimited access to vibranium. So what can we learn from a utopian vision that's based on a made-up and impossible natural resource?
There are all kinds of utopian visions that are out there that are currently driving our politics. I mean, it's remarkable to think about, again, the free market as a utopian concept. If you just subject everyone in the world to the same free market principles, the magic of the market will give out everyone's, you know, goods and services in the measure that they need. And all of these things drive policy. And so it doesn't have to be a fantastical element like vibranium to be part of a utopian vision. When the film really does approach its most powerful moments, it's not about vibranium at all, but it's about the connection between people. What's the feasibility of creating an equitable relationship between the people who have been disempowered through slavery and colonization and the rest of the world?
I'm glad you said that, because I was looking at this article by Jim Geraghty at the National Review, who loved the film. But he said, we know Wakanda can't exist. And it's not just because vibranium is fictional. Wakanda can't exist, not owing to any inherent flaw in Africans, but because of the inherent flaws of human beings. Every human society involves trade-offs. If you want more security, you're probably going to have less freedom from surveillance and fewer civil liberties. If you want to avoid the paralysis of division, you have to concentrate power. But absolute power corrupts, absolutely.
Right.
In theory, you can avoid wealth disparity through socialism, but collective destroys the incentives to create, innovate, and work hard, he wrote, and a corrupt few inevitably rise to the top, creating new wealth disparities. People have to choose what values they prioritize in their nation.
It's a little bit of a conceit to say that, well, we really can't be realistic as we're the ones sitting on more of the resources and the affluence, right?
Mm-hmm.
To think through the problem of relations between white and black and brown populations around the world, the global South versus the North, all of that stuff is really front and center. And what happens with Wakanda, of course, is a kind of suspicion that this wealth is even possible because it's seen as being, quote unquote, a nation of farmers and herders, right? That stereotype is part of what the problem is, because believe it or not, when you see the president making a comment about people from Haiti or from Africa basically living in the pits of hell, part of that is actually about not understanding the real resource of places like Africa or Haiti, which are its people. I mean, vibranium, in so many respects, is actually a powerful metaphor for the untapped potential of Africa and its people. What kind of fantastic futures are possible if we really think about the resources of these populations that have been ignored and overlooked? They're already in our midst. We literally have vibranium living in our communities around this country that we have yet to take full advantage of by investing in it and allowing people to grow and be contributing members of society. Would we invest in that the way we might invest in a space age metal if given the opportunity?
Nathan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at Johns Hopkins University and co-host of the weekly podcast Backstory. And while you're contemplating mythical places, I suggest you try checking out the refreshingly bizarre inner lives of our producers, as reflected in the OTM newsletter. Just go to onthemedia.org to subscribe.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.